Well, I don't know if any of you listened to P.D.Q. Bach. P.D.Q. Bach was this creation of Peter Schickele, where P.D.Q. Bach is the 20th of Bach's odd children and the oddest of his odd children. But he would always have these concerts and he would say, and now we've come to the part of the program you've all been looking for, the end. And here we are in our last meeting for the Sermon on the Mount. And we're going to be going right back to the beginning here over on number three, talking about how did this thing begin and how has it come to its conclusion. I want to talk first, though, about the section at the beginning of what we read, building your house on rock, building your house on sand. And there are all sorts of ways to take that in the context. You could think of it very directly in terms of the teaching, because he said, he who takes this teaching to heart is building his house on rock. And if you're not taking this teaching to heart, then you are building on sand. So what does it mean to take the teaching to heart? How do we understand that? And again, not just the teaching in terms of what he's done in chapter 7, what we've been listening to last week about false prophets, but think of the whole of the Sermon on the Mount, from where he started. Remember, the Sermon on the Mount is an overview of the Christian life. These are the things that make the Christian life distinctive. People can be surprised because while there are things that have come up along the way related to the Ten Commandments, in a way the Sermon on the Mount presupposes the Ten Commandments. It presupposes all those things that we would think of as part of natural morality. It presupposes a lot of the things that are out of the Old Testament. It is raising the bar in terms of what is expected, because it's bringing you into this new kind of life, this life that is only possible through grace. So as you're going along in that Sermon on the Mount, you should be feeling as though you're reading something impossible. You should be really reading it and feeling as though, oh my gosh, I'm not coming anywhere close to this. Not so that you panic, but so that you come to appreciate, this is something that God is going to make possible in me. I'm not just going to do this on my own steam, on my own gas. That's why the teaching on prayer is so central to the Sermon on the Mount. You are asking God to make this way of life, this Christian way of life, possible in you, because it's not happening by nature. The things that are talked about in the Sermon on the Mount, they're not going to be in Plato, they're not going to be in Aristotle, they're not going to be, in other words, in a however admirable, naturally known, naturally reasoned out morality. The bar is just a lot higher. So let's take some of the things that can be understood by building your house on rock versus building your house on sand. Notice that I drew like a house on rock here and a house on sand. And so here's the order. I know some of you, when it comes to architecture, Dr. Hippler, keep your day job. All of my children are artistically given. I don't know where they must skip a generation because they aren't getting it from me. But I put in order there: rain, floods, wind. And some of the commentaries here will focus on the steps that you see there of rain, floods, wind. So Chrysostom, St. John Chrysostom, he will take this passage and he will say, as you look at the rain, the flood, the wind, what is it that allows people to survive patience in trials? So at the time he's writing kind of at the end of the persecutions, that was going on kind of like just before he was born. But there's still the memory of the way in which Christians suffered. And there's certainly, Chrysostom suffered himself from the empress. So there were trials that he himself endured, holding the line on the Catholic faith versus those powers out there. And of course, now the problem is the emperor and the empress, they're Christians. But they still feel as though they can boss you around, even when you're the archbishop, even when you're the Patriarch of Constantinople. So there were a number of very difficult times, even exile, that he endured. What is it that is going to allow you to have patience? And he will talk about how it is that, you know, that you are able to stand up to the trials that are signified by the rains and the floods and the wind. This shows that you have really anchored yourself in what Christ teaches. So think in particular about the trust in providence, that you trust that God will provide, that you have not put your happiness in some kind of earthly status or power. If you really have accepted the Beatitudes and taken it to your heart, that is going to fortify you in time of trial, because you don't think that it was about having the money in the bank and the sun shining and everybody in health. You are actually able to be a Job who says, "Naked I came into the world, naked I go out, blessed be the name of the Lord." Even when the people are around you are telling you, curse God and die, you are able, because of where you've put your happiness, to have patience in those trials. St. John Cassian goes a different way. Just, by the way, as an aside, if you're not familiar with St. John Cassian, he's a writer in the early church. He was writing, I think, in the 700s-800s. And the book of his that had that held on through the Middle Ages, the conferences. And what the conferences are these discussions among monks about monastic life, the Christian life, a prayer life. And even though they're all religious, they're all living this life of religious perfection, there's a lot for us as lay people to learn from these. For example, St. John Cassian was the one that from which I learned the importance of discernment. These monks are all, it's kind of these younger monks, and there's the old monk, and they're all, and he asks them, what do you think is the most important in the spiritual life? And some of them say penitence, and some of them say prayer, and some of them say, you know, fasting, and some of them say reading holy writings. And this old monk says, all of those things are good, but unless you have discernment, you won't do any of them well. It's discernment that allows you to see, I'm being excessive about my fasting. Or it's discernment that allows you to see, I'm not understanding what this holy writing is trying to tell me. Or it's discernment that allows you to see, this is the kind of time that I should be giving to prayer in the way that I'm doing it. So the way that we talk about prudence in the moral life, you can't be living well or making the right choices unless you have good judgment. That's what discernment is in the spiritual life. It could be we think about discernment as like discerning a vocation or discerning a job, but in general, with the Christian life, discernment always has to be there. Anyway, I learned that from St. John Cassian. Thomas Aquinas, his favorite spiritual writings were the conferences of St. John Cassian. That was what formed his spiritual life. Anyway, he will talk about how it is that to build your house on sand means that you have these faults and imperfections which you aren't addressing, which you don't really seem to be aware, and they're, as it were, eroding your spiritual life. Bless you. So to have your house built on rock means you're not just addressing the things that are sort of the obvious faults. You're addressing your own imperfections or sinful inclinations. If I were to illustrate this from one of the books in the curriculum, in Mere Christianity, book 4 of Mere Christianity, which the juniors read, Lewis will talk about, as you go deeper in a Christian life, you will note, you not only do you have a better sense of your sins, your sinful choices and behaviors, but you have a better awareness of your sinful tendencies. So If I sort of snap at somebody, I will talk about how it is that I'm tired, or I'm cranky, or I'm edgy, or I'm hungry. But what's really going on there is the tired, edgy, cranky business, that's exposing something that's there that really I'm able to control most of the time, but when I'm tired, hungry, angry, right, I'm not able to control it. So he said, it's like if you go down to the cellar and you turn on the lights and there are mice and now they scatter. The lights didn't create the mice. The lights made it obvious that they were there. So what it is you do when you are not fully under rational control, that's still you. And those are the things, in a way, that can be the most important to work on. And when you don't work on them, in a way, they're still there growing. Because if they're not addressed, then what they do is grow. So that's why in a spiritual life, it isn't just, what am I doing wrong that maybe I bring to confession, I've done this. It's also, what is it that I'm really having to keep under control? That when I'm not fully in control, out it comes. Okay? So that's what John Cashin talks about in terms of that house of sand. Working on sins, but not working on inclinations, tendencies, imperfections. These are the things that allow the bigger sins, as it were, to take root. Finally, St. Thomas, again, talking about the same passage, will talk about how it is that people who build on the intellect versus people who build on charity. And that may sound like an odd contrast, because you think of St. Thomas as being all about the intellect. But St. Thomas says the intellect works generally. It works in terms of, you know, abstractions and universals, whereas our choices are all about the here and now. They're about, you know, am I stealing this, this thing that belongs to my neighbor, or eating too much of this food, or there are all sorts of things which people they get in general, but when it comes to their concrete choices, then that general isn't kicking in. My favorite example of this is the year that Jason Everett came and he gave this talk on chastity to our high school students, and it was very well received. A week later, we catch this sophomore boy making out with a junior girl at the bottom of one of the stairwells. And the dean of students, wasn't Mr. McElroy, this was years ago, different dean of students back then, he talks to this boy and he says, well, we just had this talk from Jason Everett. And this boy says, yeah, it was a great talk. So, if it's like chastity, self-control, right, up here as a kind of an ideal or a kind of a virtue, or as we say in the modern world, a kind of a value, yeah, he's all for it. But if some pretty junior girl gives you the come hither look down the stairwell, well, like all of that Jason Everett chastity theology of the body stuff just goes right out the window. Okay? So that's the difference between it. St. Thomas is not, as it were, disparaging the intellect. It's just when it comes to action, intellect is like up here. It's general. But choices are down here. They're all about the here and now, what's in front of me. And a big part of what determines your choice is not so much what you know as what have you been choosing up to that point. What kind of habits have you formed from your choices? So the person who builds on sand, it's like they've got this kind of understanding of the good, but it's not really rooted in their affections or their habits. So when you have this sequence here, rain, flood, wind, St. Thomas will say, this is the rain is like the attack of the flesh. The flood's now more serious, the attack of the world. The wind, more serious still, like the attack of the devil. Okay, remember, this is what used to be called the threefold temptation. We are tempted from the inside by our own fallen human condition. That's the flesh. We're tempted from the outside by, you know, all the bad suggestions we hear and bad examples we see. That's what he's calling the floods. And then finally, some number of our temptations, we don't know how many, we can't always identify them, are from the devil. Okay. One of the things that comes up when I'm doing the Screwtape Letters with the 10th graders, well, do all of our temptations come from the devil? Right. And I have to point out to them, when you were taking cookies from the cookie jar at age 5, no devil had to suggest that to you. When I was jumping on the bed at age 4, my parents had told me, stop jumping on the bed. And there I was, I believe I can fly, right? I am jumping on the bed. And you know what happened? Bed is next to a wall. Boom! I went right in and I knocked my 2 front baby teeth out. Thankfully, it was my baby teeth. Yeah, they told me not to jump on the bed for a reason. But did I need a devil? Go ahead and jump. Nope. I could come up with that idea all by myself. So, you can come up with bad ideas when you're 4 or 5 years old. Certainly you can come up with bad ideas when you're 15 or 25 or 55. You can come up with them all the way. But there are things, periodically, maybe every once in a while we have some kind of insight or hint that just seems beyond the normal run of temptation that would just come from your own fallen nature or from the people outside you. You know, so you don't know. But some amount of that actually is from an enemy intelligence. Okay, let's move over here. We're talking about building on rock, building on sand. One of the things that I've mentioned before during the course of this is just the importance of the devout life. And I know that I've given this example before, but I think it's worth revisiting in light of the Sermon on the Mount. In Japan, remember, Francis Xavier begins to evangelize Japan, or people who actually come right after him. And no, he made it to Japan. That's right, he didn't make it to China. So Francis Xavier starts the missions in Japan. And by the 1600s, there's a pretty impressive or pretty sizable Christian community. Then about in the middle of the 1600s, there's a shogunate that decides, nope, this is Western influence. We don't want any Westerners. We don't want any Europeans. And they shut Japan to the rest of the world, and they make Christianity illegal. And in the cities, so in your major cities in Japan, it's just impossible to be a Christian. They're so thorough at rooting them out, searching them out, and they use torture. They have used various forms of physical torture, psychological torture. A very depressing book to read about the whole affair, Shoshako Endo's Silence, which was made into a movie about 10 years ago. I admire the storytelling in Silence, but I think ultimately Shoshako Endo despairs. I think the book ultimately is a despairing book. Anyway, the U.S. reopened Japan in the 1860s, Commodore Perry. And basically we forced them open, you're going to receive our goods. And they created these kind of like, I don't know, commercial centers where Europeans could come into Japan and do trade. We basically muscled our way in. And the Catholic Church set up chapels and churches for the people who were there as Europeans. So there are Italians there and Spanish and other groups, Southern Germans. So they have a Catholic church for those people as they're in Japan. Well, the pastor of one of these churches, Bernard Penijon is the pastor, and he sees no Japanese people. Japanese people are still very disapproved of, condemned to go to Catholic churches. So 2 years go by. Japanese never set foot in his church. It's only Europeans. And then, what is that, the Feast of St. Patrick there? Yeah, March 17th, 1865, in his church in Nagasaki, this group of 15, some of them old, many of them young, they come into the church and they're looking around. And they don't ask him things right away. They're kind of checking the place out, looking around. And then one of them comes forward and says, "Do you serve the great chief in Rome?" And he works, yes, I represent Pius IX. That was the Pope at the time. Yes, Pius IX is the Pope of Rome. And yes, I would be his representative here. "Do you have children?" And he says, "Well, I have many spiritual children. My flock are my children. But no, it's not allowed for us to marry and to have children." And they start crying. By the way, every time I reread it, I just start getting teary-eyed. I must be getting soft in my old age. Because they have been waiting for the priests to come back. Finally, there's this one of the older women. She looks around. "Do you have a statue of Muriya?" Well, he's not quite sure about the Japanese. "The Mother of God, do you have a statue of Muriya?" And he shows her where the statue of Mary is. They are all exultant. And what he finds out is that they tell him, "There are many of us that have the same heart as you. We have the same heart as you." That's what they tell Father Petitjean. So for almost 200 years, these Christians, largely in rural areas, fishing villages, not in the metro, they have been preserving the faith. How? Nothing written down. It's all oral. There are some things that they have, but they're very difficult to hide and they're very fragmentary. Apparently, I saw this thing as I was looking this up again. There's this book that has some of these things, and it's a kind of a mix of catechism and Bible and saint stories in Japanese that these people had. But generally, they were passing it on orally. There's a painting that would be popular of the Buddha's mother. And what they would do is kind of tweak it. It would have these things in it that would allow them to hang it up, and it would look kind of like something Buddhist. But really, it was Our Lady. Also, Buddhists have prayer beads. And what they would be doing is saying the rosary on the Buddhist prayer beads. So there are all these things they were doing. They had baptism, because you don't need a priest for baptism. They had marriage, because you can witness a marriage. Priest isn't essential for marriage, absolutely speaking. I mean, canonically, yes, but no priest around for 200 years. You can get a dispensation for that. But, of course, they didn't have any of the last rites. They didn't have confirmation. They would have this meeting where they would eat bread. But what they were doing is remembering the Eucharist, and they were reminding. So essentially, they were taking a form of spiritual communion. They remembered what the Eucharist was. They're eating unconsecrated bread, but thinking of the consecrated bread that they can't have. So the thing that I think is just profound about this example, these are people who, they have the bare minimum of a sacramental life. They got baptism and marriage. That's it. They have no priests. But they held on for two centuries. That shows you how important the devout life is. How important, what is it you do every day apart from Mass? Not that you're going to church every Sunday or even that you're making daily Mass. What is it you do by way of morning prayer, evening prayer, the rosary, spiritual reflection, because that's what allowed these people to survive. Conversely, think about all the people that, you know, even in an age of parish closings, let's face it, Catholic churches are like McDonald's or Culver's. I mean, they're everywhere. You know, by and large, it really is kind of sacraments on tap. And yet, the numbers just keep going down. If you think about the last 50 years, it's very difficult to come up with a sociologically measurable category in the Catholic Church that isn't on its way down. There are blips up every once in a while, but if you pan back, the overall trajectory is down. So what happened? One of the big things that happened in the 1960s was the hit to the hull in terms of the devotional life. No, we're going to focus on the Eucharist. We don't need... Why are these old ladies saying the rosary before Mass? Stop that. We're focusing on the Eucharist during Mass. Why are we doing adoration? Stop that. All that rich devotional life was torpedoed. And what people didn't recognize is when you emphasize the Eucharist as the source and summit of human life, of the Christian life or spiritual life, that doesn't... Source and summit doesn't mean that all the other stuff is expendable. The Eucharist really is a hard thing to access directly. There are all these other things that support that and make that access possible. So one of the beautiful things you would see about these Franciscan North Steubenville retreats is they would be getting kids into adoration again. They would be reintroducing them to adoration. By the way, conversely, when I was at Boston College, this fellow was no longer there, one of the priests who was in charge of the chaplaincy would say, why should we have adoration? You don't go to somebody's house and, like, worship your dinner. So he really had this idea that we're just having some kind of communal dinner, communal meal together. Congratulations, you're a Presbyterian. You know, the idea of the Eucharist is that you are body, blood, soul, and divinity entering into the supernatural life, and that in adoration you're internalizing what you receive. I mean, you're internalizing mentally, this is how great what I am receiving in the Eucharist. That's why you're adoring it. You're adoring the Lord who's coming to you. And when you remove all those things, then it does turn into a memorial of the Last Supper. And as one cardinal wrote around the time of the council, we are now breathing the thin air of Calvinist spirituality. What did you want to say?
I think it's the first reading today, and it says about the importance of teaching your children and your grandchildren.
Oh, okay.
And it came to mind that way, and how we can so take so much for granted, like, well, this is going to be around forever. You name it.
Yeah, and for us, I don't think we're under that illusion. You know, I don't think anybody in this room is under that illusion. I mean, one of the reasons that you invest in the sacrifice of putting your kids in Catholic schools is because you know that it really does make a difference. And many of you take the trouble, whether you send them to a Catholic school, you make that a priority. When you're sending them to secular schools, you are snooping around for where is focus. Where is the campus ministry? You are making that a big bright target in terms of the school. So that I think it, for us, you know, we don't take that for granted precisely. And for many of us, I think because of our own lived experience. So I came into the Catholic Church when I was a junior in high school. When I was coming in, almost all the Catholic kids I knew were getting confirmed and leaving. It was like I was going into a building where I had to keep working my way around people who are filing out, going in almost in through the out door. But the people of my generation, what did they know? They had all been in public school. Their catechesis in their parish was terrible. Their parents, I don't think, knew a lot themselves. And certainly to the degree they knew things, they were still living back in the 50s and 60s. They were still counting on the environment somehow to keep them Catholic or do the job. So that once, and I quite frankly, I think that a lot of kids in my generation who left the church, I don't think they went back. Because there was nothing for them to go back to. The people of my dad's generation, he was born in 1935, who made you? God made you. Why did he make you? To know, love him, and serve him in this life and the next. people who came of age in the 70s and 80s, they don't have anything remotely like that. God is love. All you need is love. Love, love, love. Right? That's not the same as who made you, God made you, why did he make you? Love. You talk to older people and they almost laugh about that. Like it's, ha ha ha, isn't this funny? We're like little robots. Okay, well at least you were little robots with a script. If you're just a little robot, all you need is love. All you need is love. You sound like the Beatles. You know, you don't there's no real content to it at that point. Anyway, let's get to this to finish off. So remember at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, you are told that Jesus is with the crowds, but that he moves away from the crowds. Please remember, that's one of the differences between the sermon that you hear in Matthew and the similar sermon that you hear in Luke. Here it's a Sermon on the Mount. In Luke it's a Sermon on the Plain. When he's teaching his disciples, you're told that he sat down. And that this is, he's sitting down, as it were, in like the chair of authority. And he's sitting down in the chair of authority. He's teaching as an authority. It's different when he's talking to the crowds. It's almost like he's teaching, but there's something special about the way that he's teaching his disciples. You are told that he opened his mouth. And you can feel like, well, how else is he going to talk? He's going to open his mouth. But the reason that's there, St. Bernard of Clairvaux says, in the Old Testament with the prophets, God opened their mouths. God opened their mouths. God is speaking through those prophets. He is opening his own mouth. It is not. He's not like just one of the prophets. He's a greater than John the Baptist. He is opening his own mouth because it is God himself come to earth. In that section that you read from St. Augustine, St. Augustine at the end of it, remember, talks about how it is that, here we go. Jesus ended these sayings. The people were astonished at these doctrines. Why? Because he taught them as one having authority, not as their scribes. And again, that brings you right back to the beginning, that he sat. It's as if he's sitting. Remember what you're told about the scribes and the Pharisees. They sit in the seat of Moses. So follow what they say, but do not follow their example. So that's the way in which he is teaching, and teaching authoritatively. That's kind of signaled to you when he's sitting. Remember that you talk about how a statement from the Pope is going to be authoritative when it's what? Ex cathedra, from the chair. Okay, so that's what you're getting here. You're getting from the chair. So what Augustine adds to this, teaching as authority. This is what I said before was meant by the prophets in the Psalms when he says, I will act confidently in regard to him. The words of the Lord are pure words, as silver tried, proved in a furnace of earth, purified seven times. And Augustine, remember, takes that number and he relates it back to the Beatitudes, to the gifts, to the petitions. So remember, this sermon began with the Beatitudes. The sermon began with blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the meek. Why does it begin that way? It begins that way because the Christian life is a happy life. You are supposed to be happy. Happiness is not something that is bad to desire or selfish to desire. You are meant to be happy. The problem is we don't, in our fallen condition, understand what true happiness is. So the Beatitudes are there right at the front to remind us there are these false notions of happiness, and that's what the first three Beatitudes are in a way setting aside. There's this incomplete idea of happiness, where it's kind of doing good in the act of life. And then there's this complete idea of happiness where you are enjoying the vision of God. That's what it's all about. You are enjoying the vision of God. Okay? What is going to make that possible? There have to be things that God gives us that allow us to achieve that happiness. Because it's a supernatural happiness. It is a supernatural happiness made more difficult by the woundedness of our condition. So when we are asking for piety and fortitude, when we're asking for those gifts, remember, those are not just gifts like asking for temperance or justice or bravery. We're not just asking for things that we could achieve by our natural power. We're asking for these gifts that are going to raise our mind and raise our emotions in a supernatural way. So what you see in the life of a saint, it's not just that they're generous or forgiving or self-controlled. There's something beyond what it is that just ordinary human beings are able to do. I picked on the Jesuits a moment ago, and this is what happens when you graduate from a Jesuit university. You keep picking on them. But shout out when you read Francis Parkman's The Jesuits of North America. So you read about Jean de Brébeuf and St. Isaac Jogues and Noel Chabanel. They don't seem human. They are simply so devoted to the evangelization of the Indian peoples that they're working among in Quebec and upstate New York. I remember at one point just closing the book. How are these people human? So when Isaac Jogues is taken prisoner and these Indian women eat his pointer finger and his thumb off, right? Because those are the fingers that you hold the Eucharist with. Yeah, so they know those fingers are important. So they literally chew them off. And he escapes, he gets rescued, he goes back to Europe. Now, if this were a human being, you would just say, I'm not going back to Quebec, they ate my fingers! You know, that would be it, done, right? I've only got three left on each hand. But what does he do? He petitions to the Holy Father, I want to go back to Quebec, can I have a dispensation to hold the Eucharist with these fingers instead of these fingers? And the Pope says, sure. And so he gets sent back, and he evangelizes some more, and then he gets tomahawked, right? They kill him. But that's possible. That's possible because of these gifts that he is just always being cooperative with. Now, I know we're not called to evangelize people who are going to eat our fingers off, but there are all sorts of things which, how much more would we be able to do? We can feel helpless, but how much more would we be able to do if we cooperated with what we were being given? Is the problem that we don't have enough, or is the problem that we're getting it and we're just not accessing this thing that we have? You know, I got to tell you, as a teacher, so often it's case you see these kids, they've got all the smarts in the world. And sometimes the difference between two students is not that this one has an A because he's smarter and this one has a B. No, this one has an A because he's making use of what it is that he has. And this one has a B, maybe like twice as smart. But he's like the hare and the tortoise and the hare, like waiting to, I can always get to the finish line. Yeah, it's a matter of what you have. And finally, that the petitions of the Our Father, that's where you're asking for those gifts. So that when we pray the Our Father, it should never be a prayer that's routine. You are asking for the very things that are going to bring you to a life of holiness. Thank you so much for letting me talk to you about this stuff. Thank you. Yep. Oh, sorry. Commercial. So after spring break, in fact, a week after spring break, I'm going to be doing two kind of bonus talks. One is I'm going to be talking about miracles. This is the book that our seniors read. So I'll talk to you about what's in the book. Why are we reading it? And then following from that, I'll be talking about the book of Jonah. Jonah is only four chapters. It's nice and short. But I'm talking about it because this is a book that a lot of people consider legendary, fictional, almost mythological. So I'm going to be talking about why should we take it seriously as history and as real miracles. Did you have something you want to...
Quick advertisement, talk about content, divine liturgy. We have, there's actually a visiting priest coming. He's just finished his PhD in liturgical studies, but coming to St. Marin, so it's the evening, next Wednesday, Adoration, Divine Liturgy, and then our own Sister Amelia is going to talk, which she's fantastic. If you've never really gotten a chance to hear her, she's just excellent. And there's a vegetarian meal.